Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.
Shrink Wrap Radio number 256. Mindful Sleep, Mindful Dreams, with Dr. Ruben Nyman. Welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio, the planet's premier psychology podcast. This is your host, Dr. Dave, coming to you from the San Francisco Bay Area. Shrink Wrap Radio is the show that speaks from the psychologist in me to the psychologist in you, whether you be amateur, student, or professional.
Our definitions of sleep and waking, and in fact, dreaming and waking, are artificial. I find when you look more closely at this, and this is the basis of a theory I've been evolving and developing for about 20 years, I've come to believe that sleeping and dreaming and waking, which most of us would agree are the three primary forms of consciousness, that they're always present. In other words, and this is going to sound a little silly, I believe that we are always, to varying degrees, asleep, awake, and dreaming.
That was the voice of my guest, Dr. Ruben Nyman, speaking about mindful sleep. Ruben Nyman, PhD, is an internationally recognized leader in integrative sleep and dream medicine. He's director of Circadian Health Associates, an organization that provides information, goods, and services in support of sleep health. Dr. Nyman completed his undergraduate studies at Rutgers University and the University of Arizona, where he received a BA in anthropology with honors and high distinction. He completed his MS in rehabilitation counseling also at the University of Arizona and earned a PhD in clinical psychology at Alliant University in San Diego. Dr. Nyman has maintained a private psychology practice for more than 25 years and has worked as a consultant to business and organizations. For most of the past 20 years, he has focused on sleep and dream health services and products. For more than a decade, Dr. Nyman served as the sleep and dream specialist at Canyon Ranch Health Resort in Tucson, where he founded the first formal sleep center at a spa. Subsequently, he served as director of sleep programs for Miraval Resort. Dr. Nyman has worked with a diverse clientele ranging from Fortune 500 CEOs to world-class athletes, from homemakers to statesmen and entertainers. He has also provided consultation to organizations ranging from world-class resorts to top rock and roll bands. Over the past 25 years, Dr. Nyman has taught at a number of colleges and universities. He's a member of the American Psychological Association, the American Academy of Sleep Medicine, the Institute of Noetic Sciences, and the International Association for the Study of Dreams. Dr. Nyman serves as the sleep specialist and clinical assistant professor of medicine at the University of Arizona's Center for Integrative Medicine, directed by Dr. Andrew Weil. He's the author of groundbreaking works, including Healing Night, Healthy Sleep, with Dr. Andrew Weil, The Sleep Advisor, To Sleep Tonight, and The Yoga of Sleep. Now, here's the interview. Dr. Ruben Nyman, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thanks, David. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, I'm really happy to have this opportunity to meet with you and to discuss your work. I think it was brought to my attention by one of my listeners, and I went to your website and I said, yeah, this really is somebody that I should be interviewing. In fact, I don't know if we ever met at IASD, the International Association for the Study of Dreams, but I see that you're a member and mm-hmm. that you've been a presenter there.
I don't think I've presented there. I've presented on dreams at other conferences, but no, I don't recall meeting. Maybe it was at a consciousness conference?
No, I don't know that we've met. I just saw that you had some association with IASD, and I've been to some of their conferences.
Yeah.
You weren't at the one at Sonoma State University a few years back, were you?
No, I wasn't.
Okay. Well, I've been reading your book, Healing Night, The Science and Spirit of Sleeping, Dreaming, and Awakening. And I've interviewed others on sleep and dreaming, most recently Dr. Barry Krako, whom you might know.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, there are a number of ways in which I think your approach is quite distinctive. Perhaps most notably is the way you link sleep to spirituality.
Mm-hmm.
For example, you say you're interested in restoring sacredness to the night. What do you mean by that?
Well, you know, I'm a scientist by training, as I assume you are, and I think science is incredible in providing a deeper understanding of how things work. But there's nothing inherent in the scientific method itself that suggests that it can understand everything. And I think sometimes we lose the context, the context of life itself, when we try to limit experience to what science can uncover or teach us. So what I've tried to do in my work is look at sleep from two perspectives and look at the intersection of those perspectives. And one of them is science, heart science, sleep science, neuroscience, and so on. And the other is through the lens of sacred traditions. And these include writings and teachings about sleep and dreams that come from Tibetan Buddhism, Hinduism, Kabbalah, a number of perspectives that have been around for thousands of years. I think the Tibetan Buddhists in particular, with their meditative practices, which really are a study of consciousness from the inside out, we're beginning to see so much confluence in our understanding of what they have been writing about teaching for years and what science is uncovering. So this is not an entire post-scientific view. It's one that combines science with these other perspectives. And I think a very critical piece of this is finding a balance between the objective lens of science on the one hand and the subjective, the personal experience of human beings on the other. And one of the criticisms I have of my own profession, my own arena of sleep medicine, is that we don't pay enough regard to the personal experiences of the sleeper. We're trying to reduce sleep to, you know, sort of all those squiggly outputs of EEG. And I think they're incredibly important and informative and useful. But many sleep doctors never pay attention to what, in my writing, I call the sleep story. You know, when people, patients show up with sleep issues, they have personal sleep stories, and their relationship with sleep itself is very, very telling.
Well, that's fascinating. And as you speak about science and integrating that with other approaches, certainly we live in a very exciting time. I've been following some of that and interviewing people along those themes. And you describe your approach as integrative.
Mm-hmm.
Is that what you're integrating, or is there more that word carries with it?
I like that word because it can refer to bringing lots and lots of disparate pieces together. The word, I think my original use of that comes from my longtime affiliation with Dr. Andrew Weil. I met Dr. Weil 20 years ago. We worked for some time together at Canyon Ranch, a health resort here in Tucson. And then I joined his department, which is now the Center for Integrative Medicine in the College of Medicine at the University of Arizona. And his perspective, the integrative medicine perspective, among other things, looks at integrating both conventional medicine or conventional approaches to healing, what we sometimes call allopathic medicine, with complementary and alternative approaches, or CAM, complementary and alternative medicine. But one of the strong things that Dr. Weil emphasizes, and I think is so important with regard to understanding sleep, is what I referred to a minute ago. It's bringing personal experience, bringing the subjective back into the picture, not trying to reduce human experience, human behavior, too simply to what's going on in the body, in the brain. I think as a physician, Dr. Weil has a remarkable sensitivity to this, and I think it's been behind a large part of his success. when we look at sleep, for example, there's a lot of tension, if you will, that arises between what people experience and what science alone tells us. And one example I think is very important is if we look at the boundary between sleep consciousness or sleeping and dreaming consciousness and waking consciousness, it is not nearly as precise, crisply defined as science would like to suggest. So, for example, if you went into a sleep center and had a sleep study done and you got a printout of a report of that study the next morning, it would designate a sleep onset time. It would say you fell asleep, let's say, at 10:06 and so many seconds, and it would designate an arising time that you woke up at 6 a.m. or 6:05 a.m. Now, when you look closely at how we define that boundary, it's a very important boundary between the waking world and the sleeping and dreaming world. It's wholly artificial. It's done by convention. So, a bunch of scientists decided, well, when we see the appearance of K complexes and these changes in EEGs and this going on in an epoch, let's call that sleep. Hmm. Now, when you begin to question real human beings, about a third of them actually report, if you rouse them, they'll report the subjective experience of sleep occurring prior to that sort of official designation. About a third of them will say that they're asleep right around that time. About a third of them will report being awake past, and some of them long past, the official point where they should be asleep.
That's interesting. That's all news to me.
Yeah, I find it very interesting. So, what it suggests is that we don't really, our definitions of sleep and waking, and in fact, dreaming and waking, are artificial. I find when you look more closely at this, and this is the basis of a theory I've been evolving and developing for about 20 years, I've come to believe that sleeping and dreaming and waking, which most of us would agree are the three primary forms of consciousness, that they're always present. In other words, and this is going to sound a little silly, I believe that we are always, to varying degrees, asleep, awake, and dreaming. I think of this in terms of the image of a braid of hair. Now, most braids consist of three separate strands of hair that are woven together. So we might think of sleeping, dreaming, and waking as being woven together. At any one point, one of these strands may be on top. Right now, you and I are awake. Yes, primarily awake. Beneath the surface, I would say that there is sleeping and there is dreaming occurring. This lends itself to a very different, there are lots of implications and sort of treatment strategies that come out of this. But the first one is to disabuse people of the notion that sleeping and waking are sort of like light and dark. Mm. A lot of people have the sense that going to sleep is like throwing a switch and you go from one brand of consciousness waking suddenly into sleep. We have this notion of crashing. In fact, there's a very common belief in our culture that a good sleeper is somebody who, quote, goes out like a light the second their head hits the pillow. And that's a common expectation that I encounter in a lot of my clinical work. And it's an expectation, it's a cognitive perspective, if you will, that causes a lot of harm to people. It ends up kicking up a lot of anxiety and making it difficult to fall asleep. But I think that we are always already asleep. And again, I think that may sound silly to people, but what sounds silly to me at this point in my life is that this idea, that this common idea people have, that they are, quote, going to sleep. At the end of the day, we might say or think, I'm going to sleep. And it suggests that there's a certain volition behind it, right? That this is something I can do.
Yeah.
Anybody who's had even a single night of insomnia is quickly disabused of that notion. We can't go to sleep. We can go to bed, right? I can get into bed. I can go to the bathroom. I can go to the kitchen. There are places I can go to. Sleep is not a place I can go to. And when I try with volition to do that, I'm engaging intention. Now, my understanding of intention is it's the primary factor that defines waking consciousness. If we think about waking for just a moment, at any given point in waking, we all have varying layers, maybe hierarchies of intention. You and I would like to create a good interview right now. People listening to this might have intentions about improving their sleep. We all have layers and layers of intention, many of them conscious, many of them unconscious. But intention essentially defines perception. We know this, that what I really want will determine the perceptual set I project into the world. For example, if I'm hungry and driving down the street, I'm more likely to attend to cues associated with food, like restaurants or bakeries or supermarkets.
Sure.
Intention, of course, determines perception. Perception determines the world I live in. So intention is about waking consciousness.
That's kind of the opposite of sleep, then.
It's the opposite. It's the opposite of night consciousness, yeah. Right? So night consciousness, dreaming in particular, I think is best defined in terms of reception. When I'm in the dream world, one example is, people wake up from a dream and say, "My God, that was really weird. You know, I was having quiche for lunch with a giant pink squirrel." The thing is, if you could enter that dream during the dream itself, and you're sitting there with a pink squirrel nibbling on quiche, the dreamer typically does not think it's weird. There's an openness, there's a receptivity. In Chinese medicine, there's a yin, a feminine quality to the dream. It's just this receptivity. We don't think it's weird until we export the experience of the dream into the waking world. It's only weird in this world because there's so much openness.
You know, I don't find your idea that all three states are kind of interwoven, braided together, silly. I've never heard it articulated quite that way, but it certainly fits for me with a Freudian perspective of kind of primary process thinking that's running beneath the surface all the time.
Right.
At the root of our conscious thoughts, if you will.
Yeah, I hadn't connected it with that. Years ago, I was walking my granddaughter. She was a little child in my backpack once we were at the university. And an odd thing happened. There was a dog roaming around, and we were standing watching just looking at a beautiful bed of flowers. The dog walked over and actually bit off one of the flowers and chewed on it. Now, I'd never seen that in my life, and I remember thinking, that's so weird. And I look back to my granddaughter, who was maybe two at the time, and she didn't consider it weird at all. You know, these from the eyes of a child, children live in that expanse of dream consciousness. It just is what is. It just is what is. And so dreaming, that capacity, well, let me go back a step. So if sleeping and dreaming and waking are understood in terms of potential being all present at the same time, I think sleep can manifest in waking consciousness as a kind of inner peace. Mm-hmm. In fact, I think spiritually what we consider inner peace is synonymous with sleep. That in sleep, in the deepest sleep, we go to a place that is so profoundly serene that the vast majority of us have no waking world or waking conscious reference to it. So it just doesn't register. I don't speak Swahili, for example, and I could sit in a room full of people speaking Swahili for hours and come out and say, they didn't say anything. You know, it had no meaning to me.
Yeah, you know, speaking of the spiritual dimension, one of the things that you say, and this may be related to what you're talking about right now, is you say we suffer from psycho-spiritual night blindness. Maybe mm-hmm. you can elaborate on that.
Yeah, I think we consider waking the gold standard for consciousness. I have a sense that most people who believe in life after death, for example, believe that they're going to come to in another life with the same kind of waking consciousness they have here, that this is it. You know, waking is real life. And night and sleep and dreams are secondary. In fact, we tend to look at sleep as being subservient to waking. You know, sleep is really just about the underpinning, and dreaming also about the underpinning of waking life. So consequently, I think most of us unthinkingly import, I would even say we smuggle waking ways of being into the night world. The parallel to this, the National Sleep Foundation did in one of their Sleep America polls a few years ago, asked an interesting question. They asked how many people routinely slept in their clothes. And a very small percentage, but a significant absolute number of Americans acknowledged that they routinely slept in their daytime clothes. Hmm. When I speak about this in front of an audience, I often get some people snickering, and I get a little bit of ew. Well, you know, I think most of us sleep in our waking world psychological garb. The way the persona that we're dressed with in waking life is one that we unthinkingly import. We sneak it into the night world. We sneak waking consciousness into the night world, and I think. That platform, you know, standing in a place of waking makes it really hard to get to sleep. We need to kind of leave, check waking at the door to our bedroom.
Well, you really honor night quite a bit. And a lot of the book kind of focuses on darkness and night. And you say we need to develop night-mindedness.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, I think in a sense it's about that boundary between waking and sleeping and waking and dreaming. You know, sleeping and dreaming are usually associated with night, although they can appear during the day, of course. And night-mindedness is, it's a kind of consciousness that would restore regard for the experience of sleep and dreams in the waking world. And as I was saying earlier, I think there are two ways that it looks. Waking consciousness then begins to have a thread of a dimension of serenity. Excuse me, a dimension of serenity or inner peace alongside of it. We begin to carry some of what we experience at night into the day. And so sleep shows up as kind of a peacefulness that informs our waking day. And dreaming shows up as a kind of expansiveness, a kind of enchantment, if you will, the numinosity that expands our sense of waking. This latter part is also so critical. I think this is the era of the mundane. I think so many lives are mired in this mud of mundanity. You know, there are so many details that we have to attend to in life today. So many details. And it's so easy to lose the broader picture of enchantment, the broader picture of the dream.
Well, I love that. And we'll come back to that topic. One of the things that surprised me is your assertion that multiple awakenings during the night is normal. Most of us dread those awakenings. What's your assertion based on?
I think we dread them because we dread them. So that assertion is based on this, a couple of things. One is we sleep in cycles. There are ultradian cycles. They're on average, they vary, but on average, they run about 90 minutes per cycle, on the repetitive 90-minute cycles at night. These cycles actually run through waking consciousness, too. And Milton Erickson's work was based on this, on his intuition about it. Ernest Rossi has written beautifully about this, and they're called BRAC, basic rest and activity cycles. Mm-hmm. So there's at night, there is a tendency for an arousal. You know, we finish a sleep cycle. And an arousal, I use a metaphor when I talk about sleep. I use the sea of sleep metaphor, that there's a descent into these beautiful, warm, dark waters, sweet waters of sleep and dreaming. And we come to the surface every few minutes. An arousal is like that. So, you know, every time you turn and maybe fluff your pillow or pull the blankets off your spouse or whatever, there's a little bit of awakening. A little bit of awakening. It can be just a couple of seconds or even a fraction of a second, but it's a little bit of awakening. If we look at that in slow motion, something very interesting happens to lots of people. People have a belief that sleeping and waking, once again, are separate, discrete kinds of consciousness. And because of that, when there's even the slightest awareness that shows up in the middle of the night, there tends to be a very rapid reflexive judgment against that. Mm-hmm. You know, over the years, I've asked hundreds and hundreds of people, I've asked them, what's the very first thing that comes to mind that you think when you have a bit of awakening in the middle of the night? And I won't use the four-letter word here, but I'll translate it into, oh, crap. And it's really interesting. So people wake up or they become aware of their night consciousness, and the first thing they do is judge it. There's the expectation that there should be no awareness in the middle of the night. I think once you accept awareness, the tendency of having a reaction against it and that spinning out into anxiety is diminished. The other piece to this is even more dramatic. Roger Akerch, a historian, formerly at Virginia Polytech, now actually living in my neck of the woods, wrote a beautiful book based on about 20 years of research of the history of sleep. And the short of it is, he found that historically, and this was in the pre-industrial era, he studied sleep writings, or writings referring to sleep between 1500 and I think 1830. And he found that people routinely woke up in the middle of the night. It was normal. And this may actually represent a more normal human sleep pattern before the introduction of the Industrial Revolution and light at night. People woke up for an hour or two, and there was a name for it. It was called night watch. They would go to sleep, maybe having a candle or two lit, which represents very little light, gradually slip into sleep. There wasn't one of these throw the switch and you go from, you know, day to night and waking to sleep. They'd slide into sleep, and then virtually everybody woke up in the middle of the night. It was considered by many to be a sacred time. It was a place, a time of viewing life through night consciousness. There was a place for awareness in the middle of the night. It was a quiet time. Sometimes people would make a sandwich. Sometimes couples would make love. There's actually a story that sometimes you'd light candles and your neighbors would actually come in and get into bed with you. Which, when I lived in California, we saw something similar going on, but I think it had a completely different meaning.
Hey, what's your advice then to, you know, I had one such night last night. I don't have them frequently, but I woke up around 4, and, you know, I did not get out of bed, and I just kind of laid there and, you know, tried to, I just said the word tried. That's probably a bad word. but I did try to still my mind, still my thoughts. Just could not go to sleep. Do you advise people get up, do something, or just lay there, and the very fact that you're laying there is maybe as good as sleep?
It really depends on some of the nuances of the experience. It could well be that some of the epidemic of insomnia, of middle-of-the-night awakenings that we see today, is this natural tendency for night watch trying to reemerge in a world that where it doesn't fit. Now, I think most middle-of-the-night awakenings are bona fide insomnia. So when people wake up at night and they are tossing, turning, struggling, even if just internally, cognitively, if there's a struggle to get back to sleep, that kind of agitation quickly becomes classically conditioned with the bed. And it's something in my writing I call bed noise. It's not a literal noise, it's a psychological noise. And it's not a good idea to keep cultivating that. So when there's awakening with agitation, I do encourage people to get out of bed. And this is a standard sleep medicine treatment. This has been researched for years by one of my colleagues at the university, Dick Bootson. He's done wonderful work in this. It often is a very, very common perpetuating factor in insomnia that the bed becomes noisy. So best to get out of bed. Now, conventional sleep medicine would suggest doing something relaxing like watching TV or reading or knitting. I think all of those activities are not a good idea because they require light. What I encourage people to do is to meditate, pray, do something that's comforting, a relaxation practice of some sort, up away from the bed, maybe in a chair or in a couch in another room, until they start to feel sleepy, and then they get back into bed. And sometimes there's a bit of back and forth before that classically conditioned bond is broken. But once it's broken, bed noise recedes. Now, if people awaken, and my clinical experience with this is that it happens more with women than men, and I can't explain that. But if people awaken in the middle of the night, and there's a profound sense of rest and peace and agitation, and there's no agitation, then I think it's fine to stay in bed if you choose. It's a natural meditative period. Some people will get up and engage in creative endeavors at that time. I think that's fine to accept. It's important to block against light. Even a little bit of light at night will signal the brain to stop producing melatonin, and that's not something you want to do.
Yeah, you talk quite a bit about light in your book, and I even think the reason I had a problem last night may have been the fact that I was up at the computer longer than usual, and I do spend, most of my day in front of a computer, and often much of the night, and so, I'm concerned that what that's doing to my brain in terms of the diurnal rhythms that you talk about in your book.
Yeah.
And have you, what do you know about computers in particular, mm-hmm. and sleep issues?
Well, step back for just a second.
Sure.
And talk about light. We know now for sure that it's the blue element, the blue wave, if you will, of light that suppresses melatonin. I was saying before that I think we're all always asleep, that sleep is the default, it's the fundamental state of consciousness. There's a biological parallel. The pineal gland would like to produce melatonin all the time, and melatonin would be produced by the pineal unless it got a signal that was daytime. And that signal comes through blue light. There's a special retinal epithelial pathway. The brain really wants to sleep all the time. It's awakened by the presence of blue light. It's awakened by the suppression or maybe the concealment of underlying sleep. Given that, screens, and this is true for television screens and very much for computer screens, give off a lot of blue light. So basically, as we're sitting, which I do too, facing our computer, we're getting, the brain is getting a signal that it's daylight. And if it's 8, 9, 10, 11 at night, it can have a negative impact both on your circadian rhythms. It can delay your sleep cycle. A lot of people think that they're night owls, but when they look at their lives, they're way overexposed to light at night. So they're not really night owls. They've just sort of damaged their circadian rhythms. They've convinced the brain that daylight or daytime extends down to 11, 12, or 1 a.m. The other thing, there's a real frightening piece to this. That there's been data, good studies over the past few years. One of them found a dose-dependent relationship between exposure to light at night, and this is on the part of women, and a pretty significant increased risk for breast cancer. Mm. We believe what mediates this, again, is the suppression of melatonin. Melatonin is fascinating in lots of ways. It's this very old primordial molecule. It's in all living things. You find bits of it even in a grain of rice or banana. But melatonin essentially signals to the body, to our biology, the brain and the body, that it's night. There's no real clock. The inside of the body, I think, is like the inside of a casino. They don't want you to know what time it is in there. And so there's no clock in the body, there are oscillating rhythms from cells, all the way up to different clusters in the brain. But the body needs to be told that, and the brain and the body try to dance with the environment, of course. And so melatonin is critical. I think we are a seriously melatonin-suppressed culture. Now, there have been a series of other studies out of Israel recently that used satellite photographs of the Earth at night. And if you've ever seen any of these, there are thousands of them now, the planet seems to glow brighter every year. It's as if the planet is like this light fixture that's connected to a rheostat. Somebody is turning it brighter every year. So we're flooded with light. The International Dark Sky Association, a group that happens to be based here in Tucson, interdisciplinary group of scientists, astronomers, physicians, and so on, have been trying to sound an alarm about light pollution for years. And so in these recent Israeli studies, they found a strong correlation between areas of the highest light intensity on the planet and certain types of cancer risk. And once again, it makes sense. Light suppresses melatonin. Melatonin turns out to be a really potent oncostatic substance. Among the other things it does, it seems to freeze cancers. In the Center for Integrative Medicine, where I work here at the university, we pretty routinely use mega doses of melatonin. I'm talking 20, 40, 60 milligrams, really large doses, as an adjunct to treating virtually all non-immune system metastatic cancers. And we're getting more and more data on this. There are lots of clinical trials and now some longitudinal studies underway.
You're touching on a lot of things here that I want to follow up on. Vis-a-vis the melatonin, a couple of years ago, I interviewed Dr. Norman Shealy, one of the leaders of alternative medicine. And he was talking about research suggesting that melatonin decreases with age. And so I've been supplementing with melatonin now for a number of years, and I do have the impression that it helps me to sleep through the night.
Yeah. I was actually at a conference with Dr. Shealy the week before last. We had breakfast together.
Oh, really? Yeah.
It does seem the whole age-related decline model is a complex one. If I could say just a quick word about that. You know, our data about what aging looks like requires a caveat. What we know is how people age in our world. And it's very important to understand, you know, that the toxic burden that most of us carry from chemicals in the environment and overexposure to light and incredible levels of stress and so on. We have to say that, for example, melatonin levels decline in our world. It's a statistical norm. We don't know that it's a health norm. We don't know that that's normal aging. And it's true, the pineal gland, which produces most of the melatonin in the brain, begins to calcify with age. Now, if we step back, it's almost as if we've been whipping this little gland for years and years. We've been suppressing its function night after night, year after year, with overexposure to light at night. So yes, it becomes less efficient, less effective. It produces less melatonin over time. I've been taking a small dose of melatonin nightly for about 20 years. And honestly, I'm grateful. I'm generally a very good sleeper. I struggle with sleep pretty much only when I'm traveling long distances. But I think that, like everybody else, I've been overexposed to light at night. I am overexposed to light at night a lot, even though I dim my lights when I can. And I think it suppresses melatonin. So I take it as a supplement.
Yeah, is there some other, you talked about blue light, and it made me think of, well, photographers used to work in red light. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering if during that period of waking up in the middle of the night, if there's some other kind of light that one could have.
Yeah, and this is a technological advance, okay? So we know that you can create light bulbs or filters that strip out the blue wavelength of light. So you can get what are called low blue or no blue lights. When you take blue out of clear light, you know, the daylight or the light in most of our indoor spaces, when you strip out the blue, the light looks amber. So there are products, I've worked with a company that produces what are called low blue lights. In fact, my bedroom has no standard light in it. All the light bulbs are low blue lights. And I also have a set of glasses, goggles, if you will, where if ever I'm going to sit at a computer or watch TV at night. And it's basically tricking the brain. And the data does show that when you wear these, even if you're exposed to light, they filter out the blue, your brain will respond as if it's in darkness. It will continue to produce melatonin. So I think this is a step in the right direction. I'm a fan of nature, and I think whenever possible, we need to be with natural, authentic dusk or darkness. But for most of us, that's nearly impossible in our world. So, you know, these low blue lights are a great idea.
Yeah. Could we find those by Googling them, say?
You can. The company that, in fact, the only company I'm aware of that does this, there may be others, is called Photonics, Photonics. And their website is It's linked from my website. It's low, L-O-W-B-L-U-E, lights. That's one word, lowbluelights.com.
Oh, that's fascinating information. I'm definitely going to look into that. Now, you're talking about light pollution, and, you know, right now I believe there is a meteor storm going on, and I can't see it. I haven't seen meteors in years, and I have this actual hunger to sit out underneath a night sky, which I can't do here in coastal Northern California. It's just we don't get clear skies here. It's usually cloudy, and there's light pollution.
Yeah.
And I've started to just have fantasies about just taking a special trip. I don't know where you can go. You know, where's the best place in this country to go to get a night sky?
One of the best places is Arizona. For a number of reasons. So I live in Tucson, and the metro area here now has about a million people, close to a million people. And it's one of the few cities in the country, probably in the world, its size, where you can still see the Milky Way in the middle of the night. And the reason for that is Tucson, and I think in part because of the presence of the International Dark Sky Association. We have really progressive lighting regulation. I've had this fantasy, which I hope one day will be translated into research, of creating a model community, coming to a town like Tucson and doing an educational program where people are encouraged to dim their lights at night, and where the community itself would do what Tucson is working on, which is dimming outdoor lighting, you know, dimming street lights. And what happens then is you can actually see the night sky. Somebody once described the night sky as the universe's largest national park. I guess it's not quite national.
Black
park. But yeah, it's gorgeous. And there are places in Arizona, if you go to the wilderness, that it's just simply breathtaking.
I remember that from childhood and from camping trips years ago. And now my life just somehow isn't in that direction. And, you know, you point out that we're dark deprived, you know, like not really getting to see the stars and the night sky, most of us. We're also light deprived. You pointed out that the average person, this was kind of shocking, but it certainly fits my life, that the average American gets maybe an hour of sunlight a day.
Yeah, you know, and that study was actually done in San Diego, a town I lived in for many years, and which is a very easy place to be outdoors. The number's probably a lot less in most places. We're sort of it's almost a kind of subtle agoraphobia. I know there's been a solar phobia for years. A lot of physicians, dermatologists, you know, based on data, we're advising people to stay out of the sun.
Yeah.
Remember, my dermatologist once saying to me that you know, even 30 seconds, you know, walking like from your house to your car of exposure to sunlight could be unhealthy. And now, you know, we're recognizing we're in the midst of a vitamin D deficiency epidemic. There's so many health problems associated with this solar phobia. I think metaphorically, vitamin D is the counterpoint to melatonin. I think vitamin D in some ways conveys a deep sense of wakefulness, if you will, to the body, the brain, and the mind. It's involved in so many functions. And because we are underexposed to good quality light during the day. You know, by the way, you know, if you're sitting indoors in a well-lit room and you look outside and it's cloudy, it's even on a cloudy day, it's 8 to 10 times brighter outdoors than it is indoors in that well-lit room. So most of us are underexposed to good quality light during the day. We're overexposed to, you know, poor quality and too much light at night.
In fact, you know, speaking of artificial light, you tell a story about Thomas Edison in this regard with kind of a spin on it that I've never heard. It puts a different spin on his invention of the electric light bulb. Can you tell us that story here? Give us your portrait of Thomas Edison.
Edison, I think he was a great man in lots of ways. I mean, he's obviously very creative, but he was a man who epitomized the revolutionary sweep of industrialization. He set about to invent the light bulb with a clear outspoken intention of allowing human beings to function like machines. The Industrial Revolution was the machine suddenly became the savior. The belief with industrialization was that the machine, and the generic notion, was going to save humanity. This was the answer to everything. And so Edison wanted human beings to be able to work 24/7. In fact, he was quoted by the press repeatedly as saying that anybody who slept more than 3 hours a night was, quote, lazy and indolent. He was often spotted falling asleep in his soup in the afternoon. He would nod out. I think actually there was a positive backlash. When people deprive themselves of sleep, they're also depriving themselves of dreaming. And we're so aware that if you don't get enough sleep at night, sleep will rebound into your waking day. It'll push it, you'll get sleepy during the day. Most people aren't aware that if you don't dream enough sufficiently, you'll also get a dream rebound. People get dreamy during the day. And this is not a romantic kind of dreaminess. It's somewhat pathological. But it can also be creative. That sort of rebound of dream consciousness that's repressed at night can really expand one's sense of consciousness during the day. I think for people like Edison, that's part of what went on. I think part of what went on, it explained his creativity.
We're kind of running out of time here, but I did want to talk more about dreams. What are your thoughts on the meaning of dreams?
One thought is that we've become so overly concerned with deciphering the meaning of a dream, that we've lost touch with a more fundamental question, which is, what is the meaning of dreaming? What is a dream? So, and by the way, I've spent 30 years of my career. I got interested in sleep through an interest in dreaming. I was a Jungian-oriented dream therapist. I've trained in Santray therapy, which I've done for years. So I have a deep feeling about the meaning of dreams. But I'll tell you, I think as important as the meaning of any dream might be, it's even more important to just know that the dream is meaningful. And I think that's a first step. I do take some issue with some of the classical Freudian perspectives. Freud said dreaming was the royal road to the unconscious.
Yeah.
I think that's a reflection of the waking consciousness bias. I don't think dreaming is the royal road. I think it's the actual territory. I think that's the dream. We're there.
Yes.
And we don't have to translate it into waking terms. When that's done, too often the dream is understood by comparing it to the meaning of the images as they would appear in the waking world. So, and we stop there. There's a little bit of a turning a very common spiritual notion on its head. The spiritual Judeo-Christian notion of as it is above, so is it below. Most dream analysis, dream interpretation is based on the belief that as it is below, so is it above. That we can understand the meaning of this sort of ephemeral, dreamy consciousness, which I would say is metaphorically above, it's expanded. We can understand it by comparing it to things in the material world. So, a flower, you dream about a flower and you're told that it's about sex because in the world of matter, flowers are associated with reproduction. Or you dream about a pen or a telephone pole. And of course, from a Freudian perspective, that's phallic. It's also associated with sex. But I think I'm not saying that that's not a possible valuable interpretation. But I think when we stop at that level, we reduce the dream. We pull the fish out of the water and study it in the dry world of waking. We often pull the dream out of its wetness, if you will, out of the sea of sleep. And by the way, this is, I think, another important reason to understanding dreaming in context is that, our dreams are most visible when we're disconnected from the sensory world.
I suspect that you have a lot to say about dreaming, and I'm thinking that we should do a second interview, if you'd be willing, down the line, where we would devote the whole session to dreaming. Is that something that you might be open to?
It was my dream, David, that you would say that. Thank you. Yes, because I find myself trying to squeeze so much in.
Yeah, and I don't want you to have to do that. So I think we should probably wrap it up here. Is there any final thought you'd like to leave our listeners with?
Well, just a simple thought that we can look at night consciousness, we can look at sleep and dreams, not exclusively as a servant to waking. For example, you know, all research done on sleep asks what does sleep do for the waking life, for the waking body and mind? And the answer is phenomenal. You know, sleep improves immunity. It can support our memory, performance, athletic performance. It can improve our appearance. I mean, there's many, many positive ways in which sleep supports waking world health and mental health. But to stop there really limits our spiritual understanding of sleep. What I'd say to people is consider the possibility that there's something else there, that sleep is not simply a servant of waking life, but there's something of value that we can, in a metaphoric sense, we can learn to enter the sea of sleep with our eyes open and see what else is there. You know, develop a relationship with that serenity.
Okay, that's a great thought to leave us with. Dr. Ruben Naaman, thanks for being my guest on Shrink Wrap Radio.
My pleasure. Thank you very much. You're doing great work. I so appreciate what you do.
I do hope you enjoyed this interview with University of Arizona professor, clinical psychologist, sleep expert, and author, Dr. Ruben Naaman. I apologize for mispronouncing his name during the interview. I later found out it is pronounced Naaman. I think you'll agree he's a great talker and is full of unique and stimulating perspectives. There were a lot of questions that I didn't have time to ask. I hope you're as eager as I am to have him back as a guest again to go into more depth on his views of dreaming and dream work. You'll find links to his various books and other materials and resources on his website, which is www.drnaaman.com. But Dr. Naaman is drnaaman.com. Hi, everybody. My voice may be a little off as I record this segment. I'm just getting over a cold or a flu or something. At least I hope I'm getting over it. I better be getting over it because suddenly my market research consulting work has picked up and I've got work commitments this week and for the next 2 weeks. Plus, just a couple days from now, I'm supposed to join some of my friends for our annual jaunt down to San Francisco to go to Mac World, the big Apple computer show. You know what a Mac fan I am, and I'm always excited to check out the latest gear and software and so on. So I hope I'm feeling up to it by Thursday. And I'm trying to get a jump on recording this for you so that I can get it out by Friday to be on schedule with everything else that's going on. As usual, I have a new interview up at wisecounselpodcast.com. If you haven't discovered it yet, this is an interview with Leanna Lowenstein, MSW, on play therapy. I contacted her as a result of urging by longtime listener, Shrink Wrap Radio supporter, and former guest, Sarah Zeldman. It was a solid recommendation. I thank you for it, Sarah. I think you'll be impressed, as I was, by the incredible creativity that Liana brings to her work with children and families. So do check it out. Attention, any listeners in the New York City area. How would you like to win 2 free tickets to an off-Broadway play titled Freud's Last Session? That title's a perfect fit for Shrink Wrap Radio and Shrink Wrap Radio listeners. In fact, the play's publicist thought so and has sent me a voucher for 2 free tickets for one of you in exchange for promoting the play a bit here. So here's some of the promo information that they sent me. It says, backed by popular demand, it's Freud's Last Session, suggested by the best-selling book, The Question of God, by Harvard's Dr. Armand M. Nickel, Jr. Freud's Last Session centers on legendary psychoanalyst Dr. Sigmund Freud, who invites the young rising academic star C.S. Lewis to his home in London. In this new play by Marc St. Germain, Freud and Lewis clash about the existence of God, the joy of love, the purpose of sex, and the meaning of life. Not just a powerful debate, this is a profound and deeply touching play about two men who boldly address the great questions of all time. The New York Times raves, the humor is plentiful, doesn't shy away from tantalizing topics. John Simon of Bloomberg News says, it's delightful, a brainy fencing match of Olympic caliber. Come see what NY1 calls intellectually thrilling, a gem. The Associated Press raves, it's lively, provocative, and witty. The New York Post calls it a juicy intellectual debate. Martin Rayner and Mark H. Stold give it thoroughly convincing, terrific performances. Get tickets by visiting www.freudslastsession.com or by calling 212-352-3101, or you can go in person to the Marjorie S. Dean Little Theater box office at 10 West 64th Street at Central Park West. Now, you can get those tickets at discount. I think they start at $45 if you go to www.freudslastsession.com. And you'll find more information there. You'll see the show times and dates. It's playing throughout February. And the first email request I received from someone in the New York City area for the voucher for the 2 free tickets will be the winner. I'll email back the information to that person. And whether you win free tickets or not, if you live in the Manhattan area, you should consider Freud's Last Session for a great night out at the theater. As I said before, the regular ticket prices are quite reasonable at $45 if you purchase through their website. And for purposes of full disclosure, I should mention that recompense for this promotion was 2 free tickets for me, which I have given to one of my sons who lives in Manhattan. So I'm looking forward to hearing his review and the review of our lucky winner about Freud's Last Session. Moving right along, we have 2 new transcripts available on the Shrink Wrap Radio site. First, we have Shrink Wrap Radio number 253, Creativity in the Brain with Shelley Carson, Ph.D., and that was transcribed by Sister Susan. Then we have Shrink Wrap Radio number 83, The Archetype of the Wise Fool with Claire Morris, Ph.D., and that one was transcribed by Erica Steves. Thanks so much to Sister Susan and Erica Steves for their hard work and generosity in making these transcripts available to the world. If you'd like to help with the transcription effort, just drop me a line and let me know. Speaking of promotions, another way you can support this show, of course, is by taking advantage of our special discounts at Angie's List, 4inkjets.com, and ShoeBuy.com. If you live in the U.S., Angie's List, for example, is an incredible resource. Let's say you need somebody to work on your house, or on your hair, or on your teeth, or whatever. You can find recommendations and ratings by other Angie's List users. So instead of hiring someone blindly out of the phone directory, you can use the wisdom of the crowd to find the right person or company to solve your need. So go to Shrink Wrap Radio today and look for the links to these special discount codes. And while you're on our site, you might click on that big green donate button on our homepage. Yes, this is a labor of love, And at the same time, your one-time and ongoing donations do help to keep my motivation up. And if you can't afford to make a donation, don't worry about it. The love's going to keep flowing anyway.
Hi, this is Jerry Trumbull, continuing my inner space explorations in Denver, Colorado. And you're on the couch with Dr. Dave.
Thank you, Jerry Trumbull, who will join us on the next episode. Now let's take a quick dip into the old email bag. Actually, our first email is not an email at all, but a voicemail left on our phone. I've been pleading for those voicemails, and it's the first one in a long time. Let me play it for you.
Hi, Dr. Dave. My name's Derek. I'm currently in my junior year of undergraduate study of forensic psychology. I wanted to see if maybe you could conduct an interview with somebody focusing on what undergraduate students should be doing, should be focusing on, geared towards their future, more or less grad school, what to look for. But yeah, I love your show. You've done a great job. I look forward to hearing what you have to say, and it'd be great if you could do this topic. If not, that's fine. Keep it up. I appreciate it a lot. You do a great job, and it's very beneficial to me. All right, take care.
Hi, Derek. Thanks for your question. I didn't know they have an undergraduate concentration in forensic psychology anywhere, so that sounds great. It's an interesting suggestion for a show. However, I'm not sure if a large enough proportion of the listening audience is trying to get into a grad program to justify a whole show on it. Also, I'm wondering if you have thoroughly explored the APA website. I'm pretty sure they have a lot of that sort of information there. Also, Googling that question would turn up some good info, too, I bet. Still, if there's some listener out there who happens to be a professor and who is really on top of what psychology grad programs are looking for these days, and you'd be willing to be on the show as a guest, please let me know. Moving along, next we hear from Allison, who writes, "Hi, Dr. Dave. I'm a psychologist working for a small county in public mental health. I wanted to write to say that I've been very inspired by your show and hope to find some time to do some transcribing soon." Hey, cool. "I often listen to your podcasts on long commutes. The only problem with this is I can't pull over to write down all the great insights and books that I want to read until later and then worry that I might forget. Your episodes on dreaming, Jungian stuff, parapsychology, technology, etc. have really inspired me. I'm just coming back to the working world now from a long holotropic breathwork weekend, which I really don't think I would have done were I not so inspired by so many guests who you've had on your show to expand my mind, the way I think about my clients and myself with respect to the field. So thanks. In any case, I listened to episode number 254 this morning, the episode about a psychiatrist's most bizarre cases, and I was struck by the part of the interview when you were discussing the rare desire to amputate a limb. I've seen this on various programs as well, and have been fascinated by this. I wanted to make a comment that I read the book, The Brain That Changes Itself, by Norman Doidge, MD, recently, and she gives a link to that book. I'm sure you can find it. I wonder if you have read this. If not, I highly recommend it. Anyway, the book includes lots of studies in a reader-friendly way on brain plasticity. One theory behind body integrity identity disorder, if I remember correctly, is similar to the idea behind phantom limb syndrome, when people can still feel their limbs after they have been amputated. It talks about how there are neural maps our brains make for every part of our bodies. When a limb is amputated in some sort of traumatic event, the feedback loop that is supposed to tell the person that the limb is gone does not complete. As a result, they have pain, a phenomenon which is not really in the limb itself, but in the brain. In any case, he talks about a successful treatment in which a person observes a reflection of an arm which isn't there and is able to complete the feedback loop. I'm not sure if I'm remembering this exactly right, but I included a link that explains it. And anyway, this could be one theory for body image identity dysfunction, which I think he mentions is that the brain in people with this disorder don't have the neural map to incorporate the limb or other body part that they feel is foreign. It seems that the treatment could be similar, but I'm not sure if this is happening or not. And that's part of the email that I received from Allison Beeland, PsyD. And Allison, somewhere I had seen maybe in a film or a television special or something, I recall seeing that work where they had people with phantom limb pain looking at themselves in a mirror, a specially constructed mirror that sort of created the limb there using the other limb. It's hard to explain in words, and also it's been a long time. But yes, that was very dramatic and exciting work. And Allison and I exchanged some emails back and forth, and I was particularly struck by the synchronicity of her going off to a workshop, having just come back from a holotropic breathing workshop, because I had just finished doing an interview with Stan Groff, which will be forthcoming on mywisecounselpodcast.com. And I should add parenthetically for any listeners who aren't aware of it, that Stan Groff is the originator of the holotropic breath work and the leader of the workshop that she attended. And I had considered going to that very same workshop, but the timing was not right for me. So once again, synchronicity reigns supreme. And it's doubly interesting because about a third of the book that I read by Stan Groff and a lot of our interview focused on synchronicity. Okay, next we hear from Dee, who writes, "Thank you so much for Shrink Wrap Radio. I just learned of it from my bodhisattva-like mailman who insisted I listen to your interview with Rick Hansen. Now, I've sent a few links to friends, but I'm wanting to send out all of my students and friends a recommendation that they take a listen to that great show. I'm an environmental science professor, and I do extensive personal growth encouragement in all my classes, since both the roots of our environmental calamities and their solutions seem to me to be psychological. Again, thank you for your commitment to the development of people and humanity and the creation of such an incredibly rich resource. By the way, in case you've not addressed this, an interesting topic for a show might be dolphins as persons or personhood. I did a TEDx talk on this, but the author of the definitive book is in your neck of the woods." And then she gave me a link to her TED talk. This is, she signs it, "Warm regards, Dee Eggers." Dee, I wonder if you're related to Dave Eggers. But at any rate, I watched the YouTube of Dee's presentation on dolphins as persons. And boy, another TED presenter on our show, color me impressed. I watched her TED video on dolphins as persons, and it seems to me like Dee would make a great guest for Shrink Wrap Radio. And I have suggested that to her. So let's see what she says. Finally, here's one from Yuritsa, who writes, "Hello, I'm a doctoral student in psychology, and we were recently assigned to listen to one of the podcasts on Shrink Wrap Radio. The intro to your podcast, All the Psychology You Need to Know, and Just Enough to Make You Dangerous, became a bigger topic of conversation amongst our group than the actual podcast. Some couldn't figure out if the assignment was a joke. Others thought that the intro was meant to be humorous and, quotes, got it. Others found that the intro to have sexual undertones and thought it inappropriate. I volunteered to email Shrink Wrap Radio to ask Dr. Dave or whomever answers emails for the show exactly what the meaning and intent phrase of All the Psychology You Want to Know and Just Enough to Make You Dangerous is. Was it meant to be catchy, funny, enticing? We thought we'd go right to the source. We're also curious if you've ever gotten other feedback, positive or negative, about the intro. Upon further inspection, we were all very impressed with your website, its design, content, etc. It's a great resource and has very interesting podcasts and information. We're just curious about the intro. I look forward to your reply, Yuritsa." I got a kick out of that. And I'd like to share with you what I wrote back. So here's what I wrote back. "Hello, Yuritsa. Thanks so much for your carefully worded and delightful email. First of all, I'm thrilled to learn that a professor assigned doctoral level students to listen to an episode of Shrink Wrap Radio. I do feel I've created an incredible educational resource, and I wish more professors would take advantage of it. I have lots of questions for you. What's the name of your professor who assigned it? Where is this doctoral program? Name of the school? What specific episode was assigned? If so, which one? Now, to get to your question, you ask, was it meant to be catchy, funny, enticing? Precisely. I couldn't have said it any better than that. There wasn't a lot of thought or premeditation that went into it. It sprang to life from my own creative imagination, and it just felt right to me somehow. It seems to me to be rich with implied meanings, intended and unintended. Yes, it was deliberately meant to catch attention and to have a bit of a provocative but also humorous tone. And at some level, it plays with the idea that a little knowledge is a dangerous thing. But I think it also plays with the idea that education and knowledge are dangerous in the sense of threatening the status quo. And then there is the well-known phenomenon of undergraduate students learning a little psychology and suddenly feeling expert enough to diagnose themselves and all their friends. And I freely admit that there is a sexual undertone. Yes, I wanted to have a sexy female voice read the line. Why? I guess we'd have to put me on the couch to get to the bottom of that one. No puns intended here. If you look through the catalog of shows, you'll see that my sense of psychology's legitimate scope is much broader than is accepted in mainline psychology departments. So I'm coming a bit from a place of challenging the orthodoxy of mainstream academic psychology. I think I may have used that line from the very first show. I just listened back to the beginning of episode number one, and indeed I do use that line in the second sentence or so. I use it myself rather than a sexy female voice, which came sometime later. I think maybe it's less jarring in that intro to the first episode. I encourage you and your classmates to listen to that intro to episode number one. When I put it out there, I had no idea if anyone would find it or be interested. Now it's 255 episodes later and listeners in over 70 countries. If you also include my Wise Counsel podcast series, it's well over 300 podcasts in total. By the way, anyone offended by Shrink Wrap Radio should listen to Wise Counsel, in which I present a more conventional persona. I've heard from only one or two listeners who complained about the sexism of the female voice. When I read those complaints on the show, I heard from others who thought that those folks needed to relax a bit. By the way, even my use of the moniker, quotes Dr. Dave, is a bit tongue-in-cheek. As a professor, I was always just David to most of my students. I do hope you and your fellow students are able to get beyond the opening line to the rich material provided by these interviews. I've learned a lot of psychology myself in the process of reading all the books that are behind many of these interviews, as well as from the interviews themselves. And I do think that anyone who takes the time to listen to them all will have indeed learned a lot of psychology, maybe even enough to be dangerous, in a good way. I've heard from students who got accepted into doctoral programs that the knowledge they had picked up in listening to these podcasts had helped them to shine in oral interviews. I send greetings to all your fellow students and a message of gratitude to your professor, best David. And so we're running long here. I better wrap it up with that for today. So send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. And like Derek, you could leave a message, a voicemail at 206-337-0622. Now, thanks to Dr. Ruben Nyman for sharing his work on mindful sleep. As I mentioned earlier, my next show will feature a discussion with my old friend, Jerry Trumbull. Some of you will recall earlier episodes, which I titled The Dave and Jerry Show. Well, it's been way too long since I've had Jerry on the show. The format is not an interview, but rather a discussion between two old friends, and you're invited to eavesdrop, so please do join us. Until then, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.